to another episode of Author Conversations. I'm Johnny Foster. Just kidding. That is not my name. I'm Jenny Tyler. And my co-host, Johnny, is here. Johnny, say hi.
Did you just pull a Ron Burgundy?
Yes. Okay. We are brought to you by Arcadia Publishing, which is the nation's largest local and regional history publisher. The book we will be discussing today can be found on arcadiapublishing.com and wherever books are sold.
All right, and the book we're going to read today is the Appalachian. I think is the way you're supposed to say that, right?
Appalachian.
Appalachicola, Florida. So it wouldn't just be the same thing as like Appalachian. Cause I got the Appalachicola in Appalachian because there's this guy like who does weather on YouTube, and he says it's supposed to be that way. So, and I trust him because he lives there, grew up there.
I always said it was an Appalachian, but what do I know?
I'm going to take it from a guy that lives there.
That's fair.
So, the Appalachian legend, that sounds weird, of Wizard Clip. Jenny, they say this is our nation's first poltergeist. I say I have no idea, because that's part of history I've never really looked at, poltergeist history. And this guy, this poltergeist, demon, whatever you have, it liked scissors. And it liked burning barns. Yes. And demanding prayers.
And also decapitating animals.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot about that. Because I have an issue with the order in which that was presented. And it's not the author who did it. The author is presenting it as it was presented to him in historical documents. So I was just like, so that was a bigger deal than the dismembering the heads, taking the heads off some fowl. But this book is authored by, and I actually called him yesterday, the author, Jenny. Because I work with this guy. Just to make sure I had his name pronunciation correct. And I did not. It's Michael Kishbooker.
How did you think it was?
Kishbusher or something. So, but it's very German. So it's going to Kishbooker, you know, like kind of thing. So I should have known that. Anyway, so I'm going to read a little bit about the book and the author, of course. So the supernatural conflict and the war for souls in 18th century Virginia. In the 1790s, a Lutheran family in Appalachia fell victim to a menacing spirit that Lutheran, Methodist, and Episcopal clergy, as well as folk magic practitioners, failed to remove. The apparition, which came to be known as the Wizard Clip, was said to cut or slice anything made of cloth or leather. Was it a ghost or demon? After years of torment, the deeply Protestant family finally found respite from a seemingly impossible ally, a Catholic priest. This legend has eerie parallels to the lore of ghosts and witches from the Old World and the early American Republic. As American religious leaders sought to find a place for their congregations in a post-revolutionary time of enlightened secularism, tales like these helped churches define themselves. And this particular story helped distinguish Catholic supernaturalism from later 19th century spiritualism. Author Michael Kishbooker tells a spooky, incredible, compelling story that shines a light on the region's religious history. So, you know, like I said, I talked to him yesterday, had a little bit of discussion. He's a really neat guy, really cool guy, intelligent guy, down to earth. You know, the majority of our authors are amazing. And it's really cool that they take their time, because you're not going to be a millionaire off writing a history book, you know?
Right.
If a local, regional history. But it's the fact that they love history that they'll do this.
Yes.
To get the story out there. And I think that's cool, Jenny. Like, I think it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's pretty okay.
it's nice. I like to be able to go somewhere and get the history about the place from somebody who lives there.
Yes.
But Michael, he resides in Virginia with his wife and daughters. He first learned intelligence tradecraft while serving in the U.S. Air Force. He earned a Master of Science of Strategic Intelligence degree from the Department of Defense's Joint Military Intelligence College and a Master of Strategy degree from Air War College. He analyzes adversarial military capability for the Defense Intelligence Agency. We have authors who do all kinds of stuff. This might be one of the more interesting ones, too. And we have really interesting ones. Michael is getting used to writing in the third person, but it still feels weird. So, we have a book about a poltergeist authored by a man who works in intelligence. It kind of makes me feel like before you even get into it, there's something maybe to it.
Yes.
He's doing this. I really wanted to ask him about Project Bluebeam, but I didn't. I'll save that for another time. I didn't yesterday because my wife came home with the groceries shortly after I was talking with them. And I don't want to leave Mama alone with an almost 2-month-old bringing in groceries. So that's why I didn't get into too deep of a conversation about things. But I look forward to maybe one day having that if he's open to it. Now, there's more than one version of this legend. For time's sake, I'm going to read the shorter version of the legend that seems to be in, would you agree, it's an amalgamation, mm-hmm. the one from the 1930s of all the legends?
Yep.
There is no account that where every purported event is included together. All right, so I'm going to get this book open that I already should have had open. Gina's going to give us some music to listen to. What was that supposed to be?
It was music from my heart. It's the song of my people.
Song of my people.
Very so, just really quickly before you start reading while you're searching for your page.
I got it already. But go ahead. Yeah, Deb.
Rude.
I didn't mean, hey, okay, be quiet.
So, something that I thought was...
That was my chair, everybody.
Sure, it was.
We did just have lunch, but it was my chair.
Something I found really interesting were the translations of the names in the book. So, the main, I guess, character in this particular story is his last name was originally Lieberstein, and then it changed to Livingston, and there was another person whose last name was Schmidt who turned into Smith. And I don't know, have you seen the show What We Do in the Shadows?
Oh yeah, I love that show.
So there was a scene in there that Nandor was being interviewed on the news, and
oh, that's a great episode.
He says, "I'm Nandor the Relentless." And the, you know, the interviewer, she's like, "All right, so here we have the local resident, Nandor De Laurentiis." And that's what it made me think of, like, you know, we hear what we want to hear, and that's how, like, names end up changing and evolving over time.
People like to say we Americanize it, but, I mean, really, I feel it's more Anglicanizing.
Yeah.
You know, we bring that over from England.
Yes.
In a way that way. Guillermo. I love that show. Yes. That's a great... Yeah, I didn't even think about bringing that part up about because I was just going to read their names as it was. Mm-hmm. I did keep Father Giltson, I think. Since we haven't got down there yet. His name. Because mm-hmm. I know he had changed too. But. So I'm going to read this legend, and then we're going to get into some of the other parts from the other legends. Because Michael actually did a great job of going back and trying to find historical documentation, trying to get to the root of the legend. What was this about? Also, was this used by religious communities for, I guess, lack of a better word, propaganda? Mm-hmm. So the legend of Wizard Clip. In the southern part of historical Jefferson County, West Virginia, nestled among the foothills of the Blue Ridge, lies the ancient village of Wizard Clip. If it's like 200 years old, I was saying, Jen. But less where Lizard Clip. Lizard Chip.
The Lizard Chip.
The land upon which the village is located was included in the grants made to Mr. William Smith in 1729 by Sir William Gooch. Yeah. And in 1732, the pioneer home of Mr. Smith was built. Surrounded by majestic hills, this is the first home of Wizard Clip was placed in a gloomy hollow near a bottomless lake. We need to look at this lake and see if that's still like. They just didn't have, like, the measure.
I think they just didn't have the measuring tool, because nothing can be bottomless.
I don't know. When I was a chubby teenager, I was pretty close to being bottomless. But you're right, I was bottomless. I did have that, yeah. So, nothing as such as bottomless. Among those obtained land grants from Mr. Smith was a man named Livingston. Mr. Livingston selected land lying along the Opequon Creek, but also adjoining the village. One night when the sky was inky black, the rain descended in torrents, and the wind rushed through the desolated pines with a wild bellows. A weary stranger presented himself at Mr. Livingston's door. With genial hospitality, the traveler was welcomed. A few hours after retiring, the stranger sent for Mr. Livingston and told him, you think it's Livingston or Livingstone?
Well, they say it both ways.
Let's go Livingston.
I think it's Livingston, because I think... A couple of different versions have it as Livingstone.
Yeah.
But Livingston is fine.
I mean, the South were going to do that anyway. A few hours after retiring, the stranger sent for Mr. Livingston and told him he was ill unto death. He requested that a Catholic priest might be sent for at once. Mr. Livingston was a bigoted man who hated the Catholic Church, yet he let the stranger into his house. and swore no priest should enter his house. The stranger, to whom no name has been given, repeatedly begged that a priest be brought, but his host was obdurate. And I had to look that one up. It means stubbornly refusing to change one's opinion or course of action. Did you look it up too?
I did not.
At the odd hour of midnight, while the elements fought their horrible or their terrible battle, the soul of the stranger, unblessed and unshriven, took its flight. That means he died. The next day, his body was buried in an unconsecrated ground. For many years, his grave was pointed out as a curiosity. And it was pointed out to the curious, what it said, but then I tripped up on it. Then a curse seemed to rest upon Mr. Livingston and his possessions. A murrain seized his cattle. And I looked that up too. It's an infectious disease, especially babesiosis, affecting cattle or other animals. And I should have looked at babesiosis, but I didn't. Strange and mysterious sounds were heard about the house, and things were as though ruled by a demon. More dreadful than aught else was clear, distinct, insistent clipping, which went on day and night. The bed linen, family and visitors' clothing, saddles, bridles, and harnesses were all clipped, and always in a crescent or half-moon shape. Are we sure this wasn't like a toddler with scissors?
Right.
Nothing was sacred from the terrible shears. The witches and wizards were now holding high revels. Mr. Livingstone, pursued by the horror of all this, dreamed a vivid dream in which he saw a man who promised to help him. On Sunday, his wife, a devoted Catholic, persuaded him to go with her. So he's against Catholics.
Mm-hmm. But he's married to one. Yep.
But I mean, it all comes in play later. He goes to a Catholic service at Shepherdstown. The instant Mr. Livingston saw the priest, he cried out with streaming eyes, "That is the man who will rid me of the witches!"
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I told you I was going to give him 110% on that. The priest was told the story. The next day, he visited the home of Mr. Livingston at Smithfield, or Middleway, as it's known now, sprinkled some holy water on the house's threshold, prayed fervently, and consecrated the ground wherein the stranger lay buried. He declared deliverance. This house is clean. You know that's from? No. Poltergeist. You never saw Poltergeist?
No, I told you I'm terrified of everything. I can't watch a movie about a poltergeist. I can barely read a book about it. Okay.
Yeah, that's true. This ought to be fun. The priest was, okay, so he declared deliverance had come. Sure enough, the clipping ceased. The witches were laid. I'm not sure what that means. And Mr. Livingston was free. Of course, we all know that after the supposed exorcism, that wasn't the case now, but we'll get to that later. Moved by gratitude, he gave the Catholic Church 40 acres along the Opequon, or he sold it to him for a dollar. The church still owns this land and receives rent from it. It is known as the Priest's Place. For four or five generations, it was in the care of the Mangini family. Recently, however, the church assumed control. A chapel has been... I didn't mean for that to sound like bad. I was going to say recently, but... A chapel has been erected on the site, and outdoor meetings are held frequently. It is the ideal spot for camping, and the church has extended its use to such to all. The spell cast upon the old village of Clip still lingers upon it, and the bottomless lake through which the witches are said to have rushed down when the priests exorcised them is still here. And the Opequon flows on, now calmly, now wildly. Which is it? By the lonely grave of the stranger. What do you think about that?
I want to know why the clippings were all crescent-shaped. It's been kind of bothering me.
Maybe it's like a yin-yang thing, and it's only half a circle. Mm. You know what I mean? That's why it's crescent-shaped. So, or maybe because it's such an odd shape, it would be hard to mend.
True, yeah.
Although I think I could do it. Because, you know, I'll sew something.
Yeah.
Because of reenactments and stuff.
I will also sew things for other types of reenactments.
Yeah.
That sounded dirtier than I wanted it to. So Livingston apparently was a tailor of sorts as well.
Yeah, like a linen. Mm-hmm. Where he worked in linen, with linen.
And so I wonder if that's why the poltergeist decided to make these crescent shapes. They did say at one point that the clippings were... They looked like a professional had done them.
Yeah. Which, you know, makes you kind of wonder about what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Or to somebody who watched him do it.
Right.
So we'll get into the story and approach that Michael took, if that's okay with you. Back in the day, I used to give tours in Charleston. You know this.
Yes.
One of my least favorite things, though, on the ghost tours, I like a lot more than I... Well, one of my least favorite things on the ghost tours, and I like a lot more than I disliked giving tours, but I liked history tours. Ghost tours wasn't something I liked. That was one of the two things I disliked the most. But I do like ghost stories because there's always a bit of truth behind a legend. Mm-hmm. And when you start to look into a story, you find something that can be far more interesting. So what Michael did with this book is he looked for historical connections and how the story may have been used for publicity purposes, especially for the Catholic Church. And he is Catholic. He's not downing his own faith or his own religion. So before we go there, let's look deeper in the story. So remember the stranger? You can just say, I'm not talking.
Are you asking me specifically?
Yeah. Oh, because the audience isn't going to answer you.
I thought it was like a Dora the Explorer.
Can you say stranger?
Yes, I do remember the stranger.
Apparently, he may have been created to fill what the author describes as a plot hole. There is a need to explain why the Livingstons needed to be haunted. Bam! A stranger who didn't get his last rites.
Yep.
Because the guy who was married to a Catholic was bigoted against Catholics. Well, she might have converted to Catholicism later on in the story. Because there's people saying, you need to join the Catholic Church. You need to join the Catholic Church.
Right.
Then we had the McSherry family. Wealthy neighbors who were Catholic and were supposed to help lead the Livingstons to Catholicism. They did exist. In fact, a family member is very well known. Mrs. McSherry is supposedly a witness to poltergeist activity. She and her descendants are integral for primary resources related to the events, but there was a divide amongst even that family, especially the males, about the truthfulness of events. The historical connections to McSherry is through Reverend William McSherry. Apparently, he was a baby, and according to the oral history passed down, documented by McSherry's granddaughter, when he came under demonic attack as a baby while he was resting. And the cradle he was resting in is actually still at Georgetown University. Mm-hmm. Now, Reverend Willie is better known, though, as the initiator of one of the most notorious slave trade cells in the nation's history, the Maryland and Providence of Society of Jesus. Let me say that again. The Maryland Providence Society of Jesus sold 272 enslaved peoples to plantations in Louisiana. You know why? They had to get out of debt.
Yep.
And that's why they did that. In fact, I think the building that was named for him has been renamed now. I believe that's the case. Another historic person, not saying these events did or did not happen, is Father Gallatin. I think I'm saying that right, too.
Just saw it.
He was an Austrian prince, which is kind of cool. Sorry, go ahead.
Gallatin? There's a Z in there.
Gallatin? All right.
Anyway, sorry.
Maybe. You know, I have Austrian heritage, too, like from the Dingler side of my family. I always wonder if they said it like real emphatic too. That way.
Maybe.
Could be. So Father Gallatin, he was an Austrian prince and came to America to be an aide to President Washington. However, his mother was convinced to have him introduced to the Catholic Bishop Carroll instead, who was the bishop in that region over that archdiocese. Basically, his mother was convinced because they were like, we heard that Washington's a deist. You know, we'd probably be bad to like for his Catholic faith, your son's Catholic faith, if he goes and hangs out with George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Beneficial in other ways, but not in that. So that would begin his career, really, with the Catholic Church. The priest who Adam Livingston was prophesied to see and would deliver him and his family peace and enter the Catholic Church was also a real person who did know the McSherrys and the Livingstons. His name is in letters, yet he and Gallatin's, who are primary participants, are both left out of some early accounts. But they do kind of talk about it though, in their own way. So yeah. It's weird how you have this really neat primary source when you're getting ready to put all these stories together in the earlier storytellings and you don't use it.
Yeah, so I was kind of wondering why, you know? Kind of going back to a little bit of the propaganda, I'm wondering if that had anything to do with it.
It could have.
Kind of wanted to leave their side of the story out to push their agenda.
But wouldn't you want to make them like superheroes in your story?
Right.
But I mean, also, I don't know for sure it was the Catholic version that came out first.
True.
So there could be some of that. But that could also go about the propaganda ways, because the Protestants probably didn't really want to push. There was a lot of animosity still.
Yes.
There's a lot of animosity in the early 1900s. you know, with Ireland and everything.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
You still had some of that going on. I don't know if there's that much now. But I have faith. I'm a spiritual person. I'm not big into religion or religious people, though.
Same.
I think that's different.
Yes.
So that's how, you know, I don't have a dog in this fight, I don't think, anymore. There was a time when I would have.
Me too.
Not so much anymore.
Yeah.
I have my faith, but I have my, you know, what I believe, and that's it. Your religious person is almost like your, you know, tribalism in a way, it seems like. So all these people existed. We all think somebody had some of these people had something to do with the incident. I don't doubt that, Jenny. But it makes me wonder what was actually happening. And the older I get, because we talked about this over lunch, the older I get, the more skeptical I am on things like this. Mm-hmm. Even though my front yard is decorated for Halloween. I like that kind of fun stuff. But, you know, I don't know if there's like ghosts and things like that. But the older I get, the more skeptical I am. And when I was younger, I would have been on board with believing it. But from my own experiences, there seems to be an explanation for almost everything. I mean, you can say you think that's it, but I'm talking about like a proof of this is what it was.
Right.
There was something that happened to my dad once I still can't explain for the most part, but I'm still very leery about everything else. But I think something happened to these people, and to what extent, I'm not sure. What it was, I'm not sure. So the Livingston family would not be the only people, though, that had something happen to them. From the Wizard Clip, you have a public historian, Joseph Berry, who describes a few incidences, although I think the first is more frightening than the latter. Makes me question the order he put them in. I'm not sure if it's a chronological issue for them to be listed this way, or if the latter was more embarrassing for the person. So I think you know what I'm about to talk about. One gruesome afternoon, Jenny.
Gruesome.
A lady visitor was complimenting Mrs. Livingston on a fine flock of ducks waddling through her yard on their way, perhaps to the neighboring Opequon Creek, when...
Which, bleep, bleep. Sorry to interrupt. I think that's kind of a funny compliment. You're just like hanging out with your neighbor and you're like, that's a beautiful flock of ducks you have there.
Oh,
like,
look at them ducks.
They're not your ducks to compliment. They're just walking through.
You don't think they belong to Mrs. Livingston?
How do you own ducks?
When I was growing up, we lived on the country. We had ducks and geese that like my dad had bought. It's a sad story. People are going to hate the story, but Dad threw a baby duck in the lake one time. Aww. And a bass ate it.
So, I don't mean to laugh. It's not a funny story.
I didn't like it when I was little.
That's like crazy.
I think it's funny now.
How big was the bass?
I think that's the one Dad later caught and had mounted. He didn't use a duck to catch it, though.
But it's good to know you can, I guess. Yeah.
And they make lures that look like birds that you can use for bass fishing and stuff.
Like, how big are these fish?
Huge.
Apparently.
Yeah.
I guess baby ducks aren't that big.
I think a largemouth bass, their mouth like opens big.
Is that why they're called the largemouth?
It's because they can't keep secrets. So they were on their way, maybe the ducks, to Opequon Creek when clip, clip, went the uncanny and invisible shears. One after another, the ducks were cleanly decapitated in broad daylight before the very eyes of the ladies and many other witnesses.
That would be traumatizing to see.
He quacked his last quack. One night, well, here's the other story. It's right after that one. One night, a party of youngsters of both sexes assembled at the house for a frolic, got up by the young men of the neighborhood who desired to show to the world, and especially to their sweethearts, that they were not afraid. Curiosity led to many young ladies to the scene. Despite the terrors of the place, like headless ducks, they were perhaps desirous of testing the courage of their lovers and trusted for protection to the big crowd in attendance. One rough, blustering fellow came from Winchester carrying his rifle. This is going to shoot a poltergeist.
Right.
Come on, man. Come on. He was courting a girl from the neighborhood of Livingston's place and determined to show off to the best possible advantage. Things proceeded smoothly for a while. And the young people were engaged in a dance when suddenly, clip, clip, went the goblin shears, and the Winchester hero felt something flap against the calves of his legs. He reached down to investigate and found to his consternation that the most important part of his nether garment had been cut loose from the waistband and that there was nothing left for him to do but to sit down and keep on sitting until the festivities were over. His condition soon became known to others. Well, yeah, because you're missing part of your big your pants. That's a pretty big part to have, bud. And in great... I love this. His condition soon became known to others, and great as the terrors of the situation were, nothing could prevent the company from snickering. Well, yeah.
Yeah, obviously.
I still laugh today if something like that were to happen. I think I would be find it more funny than be scared about him. Like, hey, it's crazy that's happening, but check out what happened to JoJo over there, you know? I don't know why his name's JoJo. Eventually, the hapless hero...
Is he a hero?
In his own mind. Found his plight so painful that he resolved to leave the house, which he was obliged to do delicately by backing to the door while the ladies coyly looked in another direction. Sure they did.
Sure.
So.
But also, I would have imagined that if he was so embarrassed about it, he would have left immediately, right? He just sat in a corner for a little while, like covering his junk.
Yes, that's the medical word for it, too. I think. This is what I think happened, Jenny. I think he was like, I got to figure out what my next play here is. And it was one he had to consider carefully. And while he's considering it carefully, he kept getting made fun of and laughed at. Then he's like, I'm just going to back my big old backside up to the door and go off that way. I think that's what happened.
Okay, so I'm going to fall into your skepticism side here and tell a horrific story of my own that I think will relate. I think that he, in an effort to perhaps entice the ladies that he was frolicking with, maybe clipped his own pants.
In that case, it backfired, apparently.
And it backfired, and they all snickered at him. And so then he had to sit down and think about how he could recover from this.
Because we want to keep it family friendly. You're talking about a little George Costanza pool situation.
Which is a... I had... a similar situation long before I was married. I went on a date with a fella here in Charleston, and he decided it would be worth it to show me a photo that he had on his phone. Mm. I won't go into detail about that. And when I was not enticed and actually kind of made fun of him and was slightly appalled, and also the bartenders saw the whole thing go down and also laughed at him, he feigned embarrassment. So it feels like a similar situation for this, for our friend JoJo, you know? Like, oh no, you don't like what you see?
So this was like the 18th century version of an unsolicited Richard photograph.
Yes.
Gotcha.
That's my take on it anyway.
It could be. It could very well be.
I like that though, a Richard photograph.
Well, I mean, I was trying to be...
I know.
Class it up. You know, we're classy here. We want people to listen to this for their kids, which they probably shouldn't.
I wouldn't recommend that, personally.
No. I mean, but this stuff happens in the books, and this is history. We got, hey, we have a book. We should cover this one, The Texas Chicken Ranch.
Ooh.
That should be one of our ones in November. That's what the best little whorehouse in Texas is based on.
I think that one might need a...
an E for explicit? Yeah. That'd be fine.
That'd be a fun one.
Yeah, it would be fun. So, you know, they also, right after that, we hear this one of the first stories about a cap that a lady, and this is in several accounts where a lady didn't want her new cap, and it's not a baseball cap, it was, you know, like kind of bonnet kind of thing.
Right.
To get clipped. So she, when she went to visit the Livingston, she put it in her pocket, took it out, and it was clipped.
Which I thought was a funny one. Like, why wouldn't you leave your cap outside if you... If you are aware that there is a poltergeist, do you think that putting something in your pocket is going to keep it safe? It's a ghost.
I feel like if a ghost is going to go after a duck's head... Hey, how about this? If you don't want it to get clipped, leave it at home.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just going to put it in my pocket. He'll never know.
If you said that, I'm sorry I missed it. I think I was like thinking about it. Like, why would they... And I was also trying to imagine like a ghost getting in somebody's pocket with like little ghost scissors or something and...
Well, I just imagine, like, you know, ghosts can go through walls, so why not? Like, he can reach into your pocket and, like, I'm making a snipping motion, so that's...
It's weird, too, that they heard the shears.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was thinking, like, maybe it could be like a demon fingernail kind of.
Right.
But no, they heard. Like, or is it something they wanted to hear or something?
Very specifically, you know, clip, clip.
So I don't know. I think something happened. I think there was something happening. Mm-hmm. I do think there was something.
Something supernatural, you mean? Or something like.
Something that maybe they didn't understand. It might be something we still don't understand today. I'm not sure. But I do think something. Okay, so there's like this guy who. That Travis Walton guy from that movie, Find the Sky, was made. And then there's. I can't remember his name. He was fishing with a friend of his down in Mississippi, I think near Pascagoula or something, back in the 70s. And he gets abducted by a UFO, right? And I'm like, okay, sure you did, pal. But the discussions he gives, I'm like, I don't know if he was abducted by a UFO or, you know, the government. But something happened to him. I do think that. I think the Millers, they, you know that story about them being abducted.
No.
This is like, I think, in the 1950s. And they were an interracial couple. So 1950s, interracial couple coming forward and saying that something happened to them was pretty big on their part to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In that time period, that wasn't, even in like New York, I think, where it happened, that wasn't something that was. Interracial marriage wasn't something, you know, that was widely accepted at that point in time.
Yeah.
So they come forward and say that. I mean, something happened to them. The weird thing was that she was able to point out where different parts, different star maps and stuff that we didn't know about yet, that we wouldn't know about until the Hubble telescope and stuff of that nature.
Interesting.
And they did a medical procedure on her that didn't happen for like 20, 25 years later with our medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, something happened. Don't know what it was, but I believe. Something happened to them. Some people, I believe, they believe something happened to them. I don't know if that's the case with this or not.
Yeah.
Because there's so many, and sometimes people just want to be a part of something.
Right, exactly.
So that could be it too.
Maybe she snipped her own cap before she put it in her pocket.
Well, now we're going down the conspiracy route. May I submit this? There were two caps.
Oh.
One she had on before she went in. I feel like we're spending a lot of time on this cap. What she had on before she went in, and she put it in her pocket, where the snipped cap was awaiting her to pull it back out and go, oh, it's my gosh.
Magic trick.
Pay attention to me now. My favorite hat.
Very expensive silk cap that I just bought.
Yeah.
Two of.
She had to go like two counties over to buy it.
Right.
So, and then in their newspaper, I'm sure we would see, because we talked about the previous episode, right? Mrs. So-and-so went in. So everyone, though, believes, or we do believe, and there's no proof of it, that's the weird thing about it, that an exorcism occurred. We don't know what happened during the exorcism. We're a Reverend Cahill and Gallison, because he was the Catholic priest in the area, but he didn't speak German, so that's why they sent him Gallison. So there was a Reverend Cahill who investigated this first. And it took a long time to investigate before the Catholic Church would do something. Apparently, the Methodists, Episcopalians, Lutheran was the first one, you know, tried to help and do something. And we'll talk about that a little bit, about why maybe they didn't do an exorcism, mm-hmm. or have, in the Catholic version, the ability to do an exorcism. But everyone believes an exorcism occurred. We don't know what happened. And Gallison were, Cahill and Gallison, the two priests, were present, Catholic priests, but those records have been lost to history. Apparently, I think Gallison had some, but he lent it out to church members, and they disappeared in time. So the land ended up being sold for a dollar, and the legitimacy of the deed was legally decided years later by Livingston to the Catholic Church after the exorcism. So even though there was this exorcism, though, things kept happening. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of goes into the whole, like, I think, the issue, because... of is this propaganda or not, because they're like, the exorcism happened, he joins the Catholic Church, you know, gives them land and everything, but things still keep happening, so that exorcism didn't work either. In that part of propaganda too for the Catholic Church, they were saying that, well, the reason the exorcism or prayers for the other denominations didn't work is because they weren't old school like we were, in a way, believe in the old world magic,
mm-hmm.
and things of that nature. They rely more on explaining things naturally.
Right.
Because it was the Enlightenment period.
Right.
And they were going more towards the way of the Enlightenment, which is, I think, is a good thing. Because, I mean, there's, I don't know if you ever group around religious people, they'll blame a lot of stuff on the devil that the devil didn't do.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's like, that's what I think some of that was with the, but with them in that area saying, like, hey, we still believe in witches. We still believe in ghosts and goblins and all that. You know, I believe in demons, but I don't think a demon is doing everything in the world to make things bad. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
Again, giving too much credit to, you know, the dark side, if you will.
Right.
So things keep happening though after the exorcism. You got something you want to jump in with?
No. I was just going to make a comment about what kind of things demons do nowadays.
Like what?
Like, oh, you know, every once in a while you're like, oh, I accidentally farted out loud. The demon made me do it.
Oh, you're talking about the demons with the new dog you blame things?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I haven't tried that one. I haven't had anything that smells like brimstone. So.
Yet.
Yeah.
We did just eat lunch.
Deviled eggs. Thanksgiving. My brother 1 year. Sorry, Drew.
Oh, no.
He should have blamed it to find out. So, here's some things that happened after the supposed exorcism. First, a man came to Livingston's door, dressed as a poor man with no shoes on, to show the family the ways of his father. How to be a good Catholic. I like to be dramatic with what I'm saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to say the author, I want to say that the author was careful to say that he can't prove that an exorcism actually happened, but it's kind of accepted when
right.
you read the story that it did happen. Because the author's real on both sides. He's mm-hmm. even though he's, like I said, even though he's Catholic, he's really even-handed on this in the story. So then a voice starts talking to the family. It orders a fasting for 40 days, and the voice asks the family to pray for 3 hours every day.
And the voice gets more and more demanding about the prayers. Like, it'll wake them up at night to demand that they continue praying.
And the girl would say, what do you want? I want prayers, you know? He's like a prayer junkie. They're supposed to be praying for the souls in purgatory, and they were supposed not just to pray for 3 hours, but until the voice said, amen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they were supposed to stop praying. You know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is this handprint that mm-hmm. would show up on things. And the handprint's about to happen here. So I think, one, the exorcism, if it did take place, did not work. I don't think this is a friendly spirit. So we have a demanding voice asking for prayers, which may like seem something like a good spirit would do. But there are other things that would happen. The flaming hand makes a return here, and it had been around before where it would be a handprint burned into linen and things of that nature. It goes back to Livingston working with linen, not John Lennon or Vladimir, actual fabric. To prove it was in the room, it asked one of the Livingston daughters to hold up an item. So she holds up. Guess what she holds up? A linen shirt. And the image of a burned hand appeared. It also would make noises at all times of the night. One time the Livingstons had guests staying with them. There was noises, and they were afraid the guests heard the noises. But the guests said they didn't.
They didn't.
Yeah, it was a weird part about it that also makes you kind of question a little bit. But there's also too many other things happening that makes you think, well, something had to be going on, at least something. It would also show up at the McSherry house. Remember the Catholic friends, the McSherrys? Telling them to not be vain, as they were many souls burning for that same sin. The voice said that Satan invented ruffles, flinges, flouncers, tuckers, and modesty pieces, most of which I have no idea what they are. Then the voice forbade them from cutting or curling their hair. Sounds like a controlling boyfriend or girlfriend, but apparently it had an issue with fashion, but not with the two big families in the story owning other people, but the fashion, yes. Both the McSherrys and the Livingstons were known as being slave owners. So it's kind of like, where's your priorities here, poltergeist, you know, or spirit? Now, there is way more to the story than we have time for, and I won't say when or if it all ended. You got to buy the book for that. We want you to buy the book. We're in the book selling business, not in the book spoiling business. You have to buy the book, but there is something I want to look at. Catholic spiritual versus other denominations. So Michael, our author, like I said, he does a great job. He even reaches out to clergies of other faith regarding their belief in spirits, witchcraft, etc. and you know, what those beliefs would have been during that time period. While other types of churches were leaning more into the Enlightenment, like we talked about earlier, Catholics still believe that things in the spirit realm affected everyday life. And I'm not saying that Baptist, Methodist, Episcopalians all didn't believe that demons could and do exist. I come from the Protestant world, and I know different denominations believe that. I'm saying they seem to look for a natural explanation first, instead of just write it off as something in the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
Catholics, even though a thorough and lengthy investigation occurs first, still believe that the supernatural was the number one cause for events like this, and if required, an exorcism should occur. Exorcisms took a long time to investigate. They just didn't hand those out. They wanted to make sure what was going on. They don't want to invite something else in by doing an exorcism.
Right. You open a door to kick someone out and somebody else can waltz in.
Exactly. Especially if nothing's coming through that door to get to the other side.
Right.
So I read an article yesterday when I was looking at this kind of stuff about the number of exorcists exorcisms. And I've learned the number of exorcists have increased in the Catholic faith.
Interesting.
And exorcisms are more prevalent. So the author, Michael, does say Catholics may have found a use in spreading Catholicism and combating the Enlightenment's encroachment onto spiritual beliefs.
Interesting.
Like I said, he's a pretty fair guy. I mean, he is an intelligence officer. You know, it kind of makes me, the fact that he's an intelligence officer and he wrote this book makes me wonder if there's more to it, too.
True, yeah.
So, what do you think happened here? Like, what's your personal belief on it?
So,
you gotta say your personal, like my deep down, you know, what's your opinion?
So, I'm gonna kind of jump back to the slave ownership situation, because at one point in the book, they talk about how there was a record of a Livingston who owned 4 slaves, which is exactly what the Livingston in this book owned. But he lived in a neighboring town in Pennsylvania. But our story happens in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that perhaps Pennsylvania, I think they, because being a northern state, they had a rule to where once your slaves, I think, turned 28, you had to release them.
It was a very Quaker-heavy state, too.
Yeah. And so I think that the theory is that Livingston then moved to the bordering town in Virginia in an effort to keep his slaves and also financially profit from them,
mm-hmm.
which he then kind of took to the church as well so that the church could also financially profit from slavery. But part of me is kind of like, maybe that's what happened. Maybe it was your slaves. Maybe they were mad that you kept them even though they should have been freed, and you as a tailor had shears lying around everywhere, so it'd be pretty easy for somebody to come in, take your shears, and snip snip everything.
Yep, I didn't even think about that. That would be, and then they sit back and have a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of hope that's what happened.
I kind of do too.
I kind of hope one knew how to pick pockets and took that lady's cap out of her pocket.
That'd be fun. And, you know, it's one of those things where nobody pays attention to the servants, right? Mm-hmm. They are invisible to everybody else. And so if one of your slaves walks into the room, nobody's looking at them and being like, oh, what are they doing, right?
Yeah.
They're basically furniture at that point in time.
Yeah.
So it would be pretty easy for somebody to...
The slaves were considered property.
Mm-hmm.
Borrow money against them, sell them to make money.
Right.
That's how they were considered chattel.
Right.
At that point in time, enslaved people.
So it'd be pretty easy for someone like that to get away with those kind of things. You would never suspect that your cow is the one snipping your clothing at night, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a running theory that I'm working on.
That's a really good theory. I like that theory. I mean, that to me makes sense more than most of the stuff.
Yeah.
See, you were coming into it saying you were, you know, poltergeists freak you out and stuff, which they do.
They do, yeah.
But you've even come around to my side of, let's look and see.
Well, so I don't necessarily believe in the supernatural. I don't not believe it. I don't really know where I stand on it, but it still freaks me out. Reading this book kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially since I was reading it at night when my husband wasn't home.
Yeah. Well, so when I was a kid, my great-grandmother's sister died. Mary Helen.
Such a southern name.
Oh, yeah. She was a great lady. Mm-hmm. But what had happened, so she was buried on Thursday or Wednesday before Thanksgiving. That Sunday, I overheard my parents talking to some other family members about my great-grandmother laying in her bed. She sees a woman wearing a black gown and like Victorian era veil at the end of her bed, comes and sits on her bed. She even felt the bed go down. Mm-hmm. She turns on the light in her bedroom and it's gone. She said, that's how I knew that Mary Helen was dead. So I hear that story and I'm just like, oh, that's weird. I'm in bed later that night, and me and my brother had rooms across from each other. So I'm looking into his bedroom, and I see he had this chair like in between his two closets,
mm-hmm.
and it looked like milk pouring into the chair, and it looked like it was a shape of my Aunt Mary Helen when it took form inside the chair. Then it gets up and starts to walk towards me, and I can't move. I'm paralyzed with fear. But I finally make, because I do this weird thing where like I kick my legs to finally get to move.
Mm-hmm.
And I get up and Chubby Johnny runs towards it because that's the only way to get to mama for help. It looks at me with like cold eyes or something, you know, like dead blue eyes or whatever. I'm like, running down the hallway to mom and dad's room. Mom and dad had their door locked. If you know what I'm saying. So I interrupted that.
Oh my.
And I told mom what was going on. She's like, oh baby, I'm so sorry to hear that. And my dad's kind of like calling me names, I'm sure, under his breath. And I get sent back, you know, to the room, and mom comes with me, and I tell her everything. And I see it a couple more times. You know, mom even does an exorcism herself, you know, kind of thing, there, and a blessing or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I would keep having events like that happen. Last time it happened was at my mother-in-law's house down in Thomasville, Georgia. I have waking nightmares, and I can get paralyzed with waking nightmares. And that's what that was.
Interesting. Okay.
And I didn't know that until years later. So I thought that was a real story. You know, that really happened to me. It did happen to me, but in the corporeal world, it did not happen to me.
I used to have similar. So when I was a kid, I would have sleep paralysis,
mm-hmm.
and it's very similar. And in my sleep paralysis, it's basically your brain is aware, even though your body is completely asleep. And so what would always happen when I would go into sleep paralysis where I could not move a single muscle, I would try to cry out for my parents, but I couldn't. But I always saw a bright light behind me. So if I was usually laying on like my side sleeping in bed, there would always be a bright light behind me and I would get dragged halfway across the bed toward the light.
Holy crap.
Before I was able to like get up and run to my parents' room also. And that's what that was, too. I always thought that, honestly. Well,
were you actually dragged, or were you, like, maybe kicking or something and moved down?
No, I was not moving at all. I have no idea whether I was actually dragged or not. But in my brain, it was always aliens. It was never ghosts or demons. It was always aliens. I think because of the light.
I mean, President Eisenhower did make that deal with the aliens in the 1950s. So. And his granddaughter likes to talk about that.
They were coming for me.
I don't know what happened with Wizard Clip. It's like a demon kangaroo on the cover of the book, it looks like, with scissors.
I thought it looked more like a rat.
It made his ears, and like the way that, see how his legs go up almost to his shoulders, like where his knee is?
And then he has hooves.
He does. Don't kangaroos have hooves? Or hooves like? No, they don't.
No,
have
they
paws.
Have feet, yeah. But yeah, he's a weird creature.
He is a weird looking creature. And I know it's something I didn't know about. I always liked learning new pieces of folklore. I think it's a cool piece of folklore for that county,
mm-hmm.
and for that area. And it's neat that it's had a lot of books written about it. This was the first one that kind of went through and was asking, is there any kind of truth here? I think the truth he found was that there were people who were important in American history.
Yep.
Gallatin himself is important in American history, who played a role in the story. So who knows exactly what happened? Same thing with the Salem witch trials. I mean, we all know those girls were, I think they were faking it, honestly. And then the hysteria took over.
Yeah.
The hysteria take over here? Not as bad, I don't think. Maybe a little bit to some extent. But with the Salem witch trials, you had a group of girls claiming they saw things and taking, you know, advantage of their situation to, you know, hurt people they didn't like or the right. community didn't like.
Right.
But you had people believing it. It was, I think, the Catholics were right about something. It was a time, at this point in time when the Wizard Cliff happened, it's a time when people aren't relying on that old these old world ways.
Right.
Which, is that a good thing? Because if we didn't have the Enlightenment period, and this, it, people maybe would have been more apt to like try to look for a witch who's causing it or something. You know, you don't know where it goes through. But it was an interesting story, and I enjoyed reading it. I like getting to know that part of history, especially when you realize it's hand in hand with like founding the nation.
Right.
And there's all these other big things going on at the same time.
Absolutely.
So that's really neat to see. So I think that's probably going to wrap it up for this. Do you have anything else?
No, I think we kind of covered all the bases without spoiling the entire book.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't give the whole story. I gave a synopsis. I went here and there in the story. Mm-hmm. If it whet your appetite, though, let me tell you something. You can find this book over at ArcadiaPublishing.com or wherever local books are sold. If it's not there, ask for it.
Yeah.
Anytime you go into a bookstore and somebody asks for the book, they're going to order this copy and a little bit more copies because now there is a demand for it.
Yep.
So please go do that. And almost every Monday, 11 out of the 12 months of the year, January through November, we have new books that Arcadia Publishing is releasing. You know, we have a lot of companies, book publishers underneath our umbrella. Arcadia Publishing, History Press, Applewood.
Which is our newest one.
Yeah, that's the newest acquisition.
About that.
Pelican. We also have our own kids division.
Mm-hmm.
So you get 5-in-1 right there. So there's something for everybody.
Absolutely.
On ArcadiaPublishing.com, and a history book for everybody and all ages too.
Yep.
You can also learn more about this book and other books by following us on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, the Bluebird one. You can also reach out to us, Jeannie and I, via email at ArcadiaAuthorConversations@gmail.com. Jeannie, what's our social media handles, Steve? Is it just Arcadia Publishing?
Oh, gosh. Yep. So on Instagram, we are Arcadia_Publishing. Twitter, I believe it's Arcadia Publishing. We're now on TikTok as Arcadia Publishing. And Facebook is obviously just Arcadia Publishing.
Excellent. Anything else?
I don't think so, but it's been a fun one.
It has been a fun one. Let's wrap it up and say goodbye to everybody. Bye, everybody.
That wasn't me. That was Johnny. Goodbye, everybody.
That was me just doing a high-pitched voice. Talk to you soon.